9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
America's top diplomat racks up the air miles as he pushes for an Israel-Hamas ceasefire. Plus, foreign brands feel the squeeze as Chinese consumers pull back on spending.
Chinese consumers don't feel better off coming out of COVID, and a lot of them have their household balance sheet damaged, so they're trying to save for the rainy days.
And why migrants from around the world are showing up at the U.S. southern border. It's Monday, November 6th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been on a whirlwind tour of the Middle East as the Biden administration comes under pressure to secure a pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas and ease regional tensions. Journal national security reporter Vivian Salama is traveling with Blinken, and she joins me now from Ankara, Turkey. Vivian, by the sounds of it, just an intense weekend of diplomacy. Stops in the West Bank, in Iraq, Cyprus, Jordan. Take us through some of the major highlights.
Oh my goodness, where haven't we been since Friday? So this has been a pretty intense visit. The U.S. sees that despite the fact that it believes Israel has the right to defend itself and wants to support that right, there is this sense that of a growing moral imperative to try and find some sort of a solution that sees an end to the very intense bombing campaign that we've seen in Gaza and the obviously catastrophic results of that campaign. And so Secretary Blinken first was in Israel. Since then, we have been to Amman, Jordan, where he met with many of his Arab counterparts, and those meetings were quite tense because the Arab leaders essentially are very unified in their calls for a complete cessation of violence. They want to see this war stopped and some sort of immediate response to the humanitarian crisis. What the U.S. has said, and this was a point of contention with the Israelis, is that there should be a humanitarian pause, a temporary stop, so that humanitarian aid can get to those desperately in need, so that those who can find a safe place to go can get there. But also they want to leave some room for potential diplomacy with regard to hostages, see if there's a solution that they can broker to get some more hostages out. The Israelis totally rejected that. And so there is this growing divide between the Arabs who want everything to stop, the Americans who say the Israelis have their right to defend themselves, and Israel who is refusing any kind of pause so long as Hamas continues to hold hostages. And so that's where we are.
All right. So with these lines having been drawn up and seeming pretty hard and fixed at this point, are there any signs of light at the end of the tunnel here?
So as we talk, Secretary Blinken is in meetings with the Turks, and that is definitely going to be one of the big focuses, is whether or not they have any leverage to work on getting Hamas to either surrender its arms or at least release some hostages. And there were some minimal successes, but tensions are still high, and there aren't any assurances that any of those diplomatic efforts will succeed moving forward. And so the big question then is, what can be done by these leaders? What leverage do they have domestically over the extremist elements in their countries to be able to prevent a broader regional conflict? Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, who Secretary Blinken met when he was in the West Bank yesterday, he has long been questioned as someone with any kind of ability to help the Palestinians moving forward. And in Gaza in particular, the Palestinian Authority is the non-element there. And when Hamas took on the leadership in Gaza, it was because the Palestinian Authority was seen as failing the people of Gaza. And so to envision that they would then come in and try to play a role in any future of Gaza, that's very hard to really comprehend at this stage when there's so much resentment, not only toward Israel in Gaza, but toward the Palestinian Authority, who is deemed as failing them, toward the U.S., who is deemed as blindly supporting Israel over the decades, and to other Arab countries for essentially forsaking them. And now here we are seeing this humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza and everyone coming together and saying, oh, we must do something. That, for the people in Gaza in particular, is too little too late. And we see the devastating effects of that now.
That was Wall Street Journal national security reporter Vivian Salama joining us from the Turkish capital, Ankara, this morning. Vivian, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
When Apple reported its quarterly earnings last week, the tech juggernaut noted a concerning overseas trend, declining sales in China. And Apple is far from the only Western brand to report getting squeezed in a Chinese market that they dominated as recently as 5 years ago. And joining me now with a look at how Chinese consumers are tightening their belts and what that means for foreign companies are the journal's Nuli Purnell and Stella Yifan Shia. Nuli, I just mentioned Apple there seeing headwinds in what's their third largest market globally. Which other companies are raising concerns about Chinese consumer demand?
A few we highlighted in the story would be Estee Lauder, of course, the cosmetics maker. Their shares fell last week to the lowest level in several years when they cut their outlook for the fiscal year. They said they were seeing slower sales in China. Canada Goose is another one, the winter apparel maker. They cut their sales outlook, said they're seeing a challenging economic environment for consumers in China. And also a few Chinese companies as well. We mentioned Yum China, the brand behind KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. Their results were down, didn't meet expectations. They said they were seeing sort of softer demand and what they called a nonlinear response to COVID, with demand there still down.
And so, Stella, does that square with the portrait of the Chinese consumer that you've been reporting on for us throughout the year?
Yeah, definitely. It really fits into the broader trend we've been observing in China, which is, in general, consumers, more of them seems to be downgrading their spending for various reasons. And also, you know, the fact that Chinese companies are improving in terms of their quality also helps grabbing a larger market share compared to foreign brands, which typically charge a premium.
All right. So continuing evidence there that hopes of an economic bump after COVID lockdowns just isn't really taking shape. Remind us, why not?
Yeah. So one of the big reasons is just the property market is still stuck in a downward spiral. And for Chinese households, as you know, they put majority of their wealth in the property market. So now they suddenly feel less rich. And in many cities, home price keep falling this year. And in addition to that, the stock market in China is also among the worst performers in the world this year. On a broad scale, Chinese consumers don't feel better off coming out of COVID. And a lot of them have their household balance sheet damaged. So they're trying to save more and save for the rainy days.
I mean, are there any bright spots here, Stella, when it comes to the Chinese consumer and their spending, or, you know, maybe signs about when this spending pullback could possibly end?
One bright spot in the Chinese consumer spending story is they're still very enthusiastic about services related spending. Like, they still go on trips domestically. They are willing to pay for concerts and other sort of experience related events. But we saw like recovering spending on durable goods and large ticket items like cars and smartphones have so far disappointed. So the key to shore up consumer confidence really has to do with whether China can stabilize the property market and prevent, you know, home prices from falling further in most parts of the country.
And so, Nuli, where does this all leave foreign brands? Brands that as recently as February, according to our reporting, were pursuing expansion strategies in China.
That's right. Some of them still are doing that, and they're still quite bullish on China. We reported that Starbucks, for example, has just reported good earnings. They said their sales in China were up 5% and that they are still on track to their goal of 9,000 stores in China by 2025. The message we very much get from American and other global companies is that it's challenging, but you can't afford not to be in such a big, massive consumer market. And so many we've talked to are bullish over the long term. Others, however, are seeing harder challenges. Foreign firms have pulled more than $160 billion in total earnings from China over the previous six quarters. And that's normally very much in the positive direction. Instead, it's in the negative now. And some of them cited some macro issues like higher interest rates in the West. So that's a better place to park their money. But others said that they were concerned about geopolitical concerns and that China just seems like a risky place to park their money.
I've been speaking to the journal's Nuli Purnell and Stella Ifon-Shia. Coming up, illegal migration to the U.S. is becoming increasingly global as migrant numbers surge. Plus, facing mounting union pressure, Tesla boosts wages for its German workers. We've got those stories and more after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Western price cap on Russian oil that's meant to curb Moscow's war spending is increasingly losing its punch. Revenues from oil and gas to the Russian budget in October more than doubled from September as Moscow continues to circumvent the G7 oil price cap. And as commodities reporter Joe Wallace told us, that, coupled with continued high oil prices, means that Russia's coffers will remain flush for some time yet.
Saudi Arabia has been cutting production by an additional million barrels a day, and it said it would extend that additional production cut. And then at the same time, Russia said it would extend that reduction in exports until the end of the year as well. And although this was all expected, traders seem to have pushed prices up a bit in response to the news. High oil prices, other things being equal, are very good for Russia's finances. Oil is by far the biggest contributor to the state budget in Russia. The Russian government plans to increase military spending by nearly 70% next year to what will be a post-Soviet record of more than $100 billion. And with oil money coming in, that's much easier to do.
Migrants are increasingly flocking to the U.S. from around the world, with U.S. Customs and Border Control saying that the number of arrests at the southern border exceeded 2 million for the second year in a row, and that the number of migrants from China, India, and other distant countries tripled to more than 200,000 over the past fiscal year. Santiago Perez is our deputy editor for Latin America.
That's problematic because for the U.S. and also for Mexico, it's almost impossible to deport these migrants. They come from Asia and Africa. It takes time. It's expensive. You don't have the diplomatic channels to arrange expedite removals.
And Santiago said that the pace of migration shows few signs of slowing amid continued strength in the U.S. labor market and the expanding reach of smuggling networks.
We now are seeing a global system in which migrants get transport services, lodging in some specific regions, and networks are also becoming more sophisticated. The other significant element has to do with social media. People spread the word, they share tips, they show how complicated one path could be. So this also fuels the growing trend that we are seeing now.
Tesla is boosting the pay for its factory workers in Germany amid an aggressive unionization drive there and in the United States. Tesla has been under pressure from the powerful German union IG Metall, which is trying to organize workers in the country and get Tesla to agree to a union contract. Meanwhile, in Sweden, another union representing Tesla service workers has been on strike and is set to meet with the company today as it pursues a collective bargaining contract. The announcements come as the United Auto Workers Union is setting its sights on Tesla factories in the U.S., betting it will attract non-unionized workers after winning record contracts from Detroit automakers. And Elon Musk's AI startup has launched a new artificial intelligence chatbot called Grok. The wisecracking bot is modeled after The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and is designed to have humor and a rebellious streak, with xAI saying it will answer questions that are rejected by most other AI systems. The company added that Grok is still a very early beta product and warned that the model can generate false or contradictory information. Grok will be available for X premium users who pay a $16 a month subscription fee. And that is What's News for Monday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.